Call this work session of House State Affairs to order. It's Tuesday, May 16th, and it's about 7:05 p.m. And this is a work session on issues that have been surrounding and embedded in the PPT, the Petroleum Profits Tax that we dealt with earlier. In your packets, you have copies of the Senate bill, and you have copies of the House amended final bill, as well as you have some side-by-side comparisons, and you also have just a beginning sheet on work session issues, and there's five issues laid out there. I talked to different members of the House and Senate and asked them about what issues they saw of concern, and so we'll go through those, and these are just the start. As we go through, what we'll do is we've got some chart boards over here on the side, and what we'll do is we'll identify those issues and then go ahead and put them up there. The purpose of this meeting is so that we can identify some of those issues and see if we can get a full understanding of those issues, and also with the Senate get a get some agreement on what the basic underlying premises are, so that when we start to work on this issue again, we'll be able to have at least a common understanding of the issues, whether we have agreement or not, but at least we'll have a common understanding. So that's the basic of what we're doing here. And are there any questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask if we could broaden the scope of our discussions beyond the differences between the two versions, the House and Senate versions of the PPT, and incorporate some other elements of inquiry.
We can. This is a work session, so we can basically do whatever we want, but I would like to bring people back to the issue that we're looking at here is PPT. I don't think it's going to be productive for us to go and say, okay, we're going to rewrite a severance tax on a totally different basis. That's really not what we're doing here tonight. If we would try to do that, then we're just approaching a whole different topic. And the reason State Affairs offered to have this is because we just need to start looking at the issues. There were a number of issues that came up in the night when we were voting on amendments that I know myself and others, it was a grueling session at 2 or 3 in the morning, and understanding those issues, and the same with the Senate, when they got the bill over there, there were a number of issues that they didn't understand the ramifications of those, and so that's what we want to do. If you look at the, like, issue one, just a moment, if you look at, like, issue one, we're looking at the gross or the net on the progressivity, because the Senate basically was doing their progressivity on the gross, and we were doing it on the net. But as far as going back and saying, okay, at this work session, we're going to redefine the entire basis of the severance tax, I think, we wouldn't be getting there. Representative Gardner?
Thanks. On the point of amendments that were offered that people perhaps didn't understand, I think there were some that were very good amendments, but they wouldn't fall under your proposal of talking about the differences between the two versions, because they weren't part of either version, but they were offered amendments that I think have a lot of merit, and I would submit that we might want to discuss those as well.
Sure, and I don't have any problems with bringing those up at all. In fact, you have a packet in there of all of the amendments as they were offered in the order that they were offered on the House floor, so that we have copies of those, so we don't have to just remember them off the top of our heads. And before we go any further, let me recognize that tonight we have with us Representative Wilson, Representative Lynn, Representative Gardner, Representative Kelly, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Rookberg, Representative Newman, Representative Gatto, Representative Thomas, and myself, Representative Seaton. Is there anybody I missed?
Do you want to invite Representative Thomas to
come? Yeah. Come up here and be with us, Bill, too. So, but, Yes, Representative Kelly, and then, oh, I think it was Representative Lynn, and then Kelly.
I was going to say, we, how many amendments did we have? Some like 30 amendments, some are withdrawn, but we had a total of 30, I believe. And, of course, we discussed those amendments ad infinitum ad nauseum until daybreak almost. So I would not want to go back and re-debate all those amendments again. I like to, this looks like a good starting format here. But to go back and debate each of those amendments again, I think it would just be, covering old ground.
Oh, and Representative Lynn, that's not the intention to go back through those, but they were just included for reference so that people would know, you know, what was offered if somebody brought forward a question.
My neighbor to the left indicated we might look at those amendments again.
Well, we're not going to go through the packet of them. They're just there for your reference in case.
Excellent.
It was late at night, and I don't remember the wording of all of them.
Early in
so
the morning.
If something comes up that we need to discuss, they're there. Representative Kelly.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. Sure. I understand that on Monday next, we may get a new PPT bill from the governor. Do you have any idea what that's going to contain yet?
I don't. I just heard today, and I'm not sure either, because we also had the sectional analysis of the stranded gas amendments, and on section 3 of that was allow the Commissioner of Revenue to develop new terms relating to, one, modification of oil and gas production taxes, income taxes, property taxes, et cetera. So we may also be considering giving the commissioner the authority to do it on his own. I mean, that may be one other thing that comes forward. I don't know what's going to come forward. I just know that there were a number of issues that, you know, the Senate and the House didn't get to agreement on. And so that's why we're just trying to get to a basis of understanding of what our disagreements are and understanding of what any issues might be people want to bring up. We've been joined by Representative Berkowitz. Did anyone else have a question? And this is a work session, so it's going to be much less formal than a normal committee meeting. We'll still want to, we do have the recording secretary here, so we do need to go through the chair so I can recognize you so that her job doesn't become
Terrible morass. By the Rules Committee provided the recorder, we're not going to be recording it, transcribing it, so you don't have to do that.
Oh, okay.
The tape will be available for anybody to listen to, so you don't have to do that.
Okay.
It's a work session.
Thanks. Yes, it is a work session, and appreciate that. Any other comments by anybody before we get started on any of the issues here? Representative Grunberg.
I would hope that it being a work session that we can consider any ideas that are brought out there. I mean, we don't need to spend a lot of time if there's no support for them, but I think that this is a time when we can sort of debrief each other on what's happened so that we get the best possible advice and can follow the best possible course.
Yeah, thank you. And we may identify issues that we may need some more information on. And so that's one of the things why we're having this now, is so that we can go to our consultants, Econ One and possibly others, and get questions answered if we have any questions that we need expert advice on that all the experts here aren't totally up on. So trying to get to a format that works on here and gets us somewhere in this work session, I went ahead and just took and listed out 5 issues on that front page, and that's not meant to be, you know, inclusive of anything other than, like I say, just talking with different members, you know, in the Representative Chenault. I was talking to him today. I was talking to some of the Senate members and what their questions or concerns were. We listened to the tape in which the Senate considered the bill that came over to them and listed as some of the things that they had questions about. And so those are issues that are on here. So does anybody have anything else before we just start into issues? Okay, so issue 1, and I'm just going to read this so that we all have audience. And the audience should know that there are all the paperwork is over at the side if you don't have it. What are the positive and negative features of defining progressivity surcharge in relationship to gross production? And that was in the Senate version of the bill. And then the same thing, what are the positive and negative features of defining progressivity surcharge in relationship to net income? And that was in the House version. And so we had two different bases here. Does anyone want to start that discussion on net or gross?
I'll mention something.
Representative Gutter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at this, one thing that's important to notice is that when you deal with gross production, there will always be some money that you can get from it as long as you're dealing with gross, which is the Senate version. Whenever you're dealing with net, if net becomes zero, it doesn't matter what your progressivity is, you get zero. Mm-hmm. And so the provisions that define for net how rapidly any surcharges, progressivity surcharges grow becomes absolutely crucial because the numbers could be fairly small. On the other hand, when the numbers are large, you could do better than with a gross progressivity in relation to production. So those two things are pretty much unknown until you actually know what the numbers are. It would be always better to look backwards and define what your progressivity should be once you already have the information. But without it, you really have to take a stab on which one is better for you or better for the deal. And if the deal is you have to get both sides to agree on the deal, and so you have to be somewhat sympathetic to the other side as well and not simply look and say, how does the state get the most amount of money? Because I would think the Senate version would probably produce that under low conditions when you need the money more and may also be there under high conditions. So I guess that doesn't answer the question because I don't think there is an answer. What there is a discussion about which one would be more beneficial to the state. And my guess is the Senate version would be more beneficial to the state.
Representative Rupert.
Mr. Chairman, I guess that would be between what you consider being beneficial, getting more tax revenue or getting more investment. I mean, that's the central issue in this whole debate, finding the right balance. I just comment, Mr. Chairman, I think some of the discussion before about going from net to gross had to do with having the accurate figures, and the fact is that because of the way the whole bill is designed, we will have net figures available, because that's the essence of the entire bill. And this avoided having to deal with other leveling devices like CPI clauses and things of that nature that are taken into account. Going on a net route, you have somewhat of an internalized adjustment for future cost of living impacts on calculations such as this. So there's a number of other reasons why the net figure was more beneficial than the gross figure in terms of its calculation. And you can adjust the state or government take by the starting points and the slope of the curve. Those are more germane than net or gross, in my opinion.
And I think that, Rupert, the one argument that I've heard for net instead of gross is that industry was concerned about, over time, inflationary pressure and on the starting point, the takeoff point, whether it's $35 on the net or $50 on the gross, which were roughly equivalent. You have in your packet there a set of charts, and you'll actually see that the House Finance Amendment, that's the last one there. Let's see, I got the wrong set. I believe you have one of the sets with the that has the top one. Does everybody have the set of charts that has the Senate Resources CF on the top. Yeah, okay. That's that lets you see where those actually those numbers came out as we were debating them and how they came out when you actually made the run. Pretty similar numbers as far as up to about
$50.
The $50 where the surcharge progressivity really kicked in and the difference. And I guess the question is that doing it on the net gives you the benefit of having a inflationary index built into it. Doing it on the net has the problem of allowing some manipulation of the numbers more than you do on the gross. And so those are kind of the, seems to be the two arguments that I've heard. Does anybody else have any issues? Representative Kelly.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. There are two goals. One is the aggressiveness of it, and the other is the net versus gross. And we, coming out of the House, I think we had a fairly aggressive progressivity feature in there. It was built on the net, so it did have the inflation built into it. And we were assured by the administration that their audit capability and the experience that they have, in addition to the fact that the companies are auditing one another, gave them, or they were trying to give us, I think, comfort that they could handle this on the net and make it work. But I just wanted to bring up that there are two issues. One is the gross net, just as to how you think it ought to be. The other is the degree of aggressiveness. And so I come down in favor of the more aggressive House version, which was based on the net. And just so as we move through the progressivity, we keep track of the two levers there. Whether it's gross or net is one separate discussion. You can get to the aggressiveness with either of those. And then the second is how aggressive the formula is. So.
And I don't know. I guess we need to look at that one other way. You know, it's been talked about building the escalator or building the inflationary pressure into it if it's on the net. But it seems like the net is actually, I mean, all those expenses are going to get eaten up in the 2020 anyway, or the 22.5 or 21.5 or whatever that's going to be in the tax rate. So the progressivity piece, I'm not sure how the inflationary build actually occurs there, whether it's on the net or the gross, and maybe somebody can explain that to me. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's another issue we should...
Oh.
No,
it
sorry.
Was Berkowitz, not Roper.
I thought it was Berkowitz.
No, Berkowitz.
It was again. You have heard of all the days. I like the Wolf Chairman. He was so magnanimous earlier this evening.
I'm sorry. Well, I already spoke, so why don't you go ahead.
And before, okay. Thank you, Representative Roper. And before we go any further, I wanted to recognize that Representative Krikula has joined us as well. And Representative Sisna. And Representative Sisna, the chair up here, if you'd like to come up and join us up here. Representative Berkowitz.
I'd also like to point out that I have two issues as well. They're different than Representative Kelly's, and it has to do with the revenue structure. It has to have two features. It has to be easy to understand and simple to implement. And so whatever component of whatever version discussed is under discussion, I think you ought to focus on making sure it's simple and easy.
And Representative Roper.
Right, I think this area of progressivity is one of the keys to the House bill. It really made a big distinction from, I think, the Senate, and I think the public doesn't fully understand its impact. For example, we are 7.5% higher than the governor's 20% rate of $70 oil, current pricing, but in large part because of this progressivity. And I think even higher than the Senate because of the progressivity. But one thing I think we should keep in mind, you know, which I think that this does meet the criteria of the to my narrative by having it understandable and, you know, relatively simple in terms of its slope and start. Getting to the net is another issue, but I think my understanding was that because it's based on net, it gives more credence to the amount of investment that are made. Therefore, it should benefit on a net basis those firms that invest more in Alaska than those that don't. And somebody correct me if I'm wrong.
Can you explain?
Well, it's based on net per company, isn't it? It's not an overall.
Right. So if you have less investment, you're going to have more profit. So
if you have more investment, you're going to have more profit.
You're going to have more deductions
and more credit.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on the individual company, I guess, right?
Yeah.
We want to encourage investment, so.
Sure, and I think, you know, I think everybody recognizes that the real reason for going that to this structure is not just so that we increase taxes, but that we give an incentive for reinvestment in Alaska instead of taking the money.
You're going to be taxed.
That's right. Instead of taking the money and running, or investing it someplace else, I think that's the key underlying factor here.
Which on gross you wouldn't be. It wouldn't affect you. Everybody be in the same boat. That's the unfairness of the gross calculation.
Well, let me ask a question the other way. This work session here, because I know what a $50 barrel gross is, whether it's West Texas or ANS West Coast, or you pick your benchmark, but I know what it is on the gross. If someone could tell me what $50 net per barrel is, I'd be impressed.
Well, as my understanding is that when we get above the $35 takeoff point on the net, then what's happening is the tax on the profits or tax on the income is at an increased rate, and it's going to be on the whole amount.
Okay, but when you say you're at $50 a barrel and it's $50 West Texas, I know when we hit that point and I know the progressivity kicks in. But when you tell me that there's a progressivity that's going to kick in at $35 net, I don't know what that means. I mean, is that $35 if I'm operating in Alpine? Is that $35 if I'm operating in Kuparuk? What does it mean? Is it, I don't know. Is it $35 in a year where I have a lot of capital expenditures in the field, or is it $35 in a year where I have none? So it's a moving target, and that's why when people talk about net progressivity, I get a little confused because I'm not sure what it means.
And I think that's one of the questions that was unresolved as far as I'm concerned, is because it seems like it's a point of production, and each field or each well may have a different $35. So it's not going to be something like there's an index that says $35. It's going to be an audit function. It's going to be an audit function on individual companies, and the more efficient you are, the more you're going to get taxed because you're going to have more net income. The less inefficient
efficiency.
No.
That, I mean, yeah, in a way, the less inefficient you are, the less income you're going to, but you know, this is like most things. I mean, people try to make a profit. I mean, they're not out there to lose money, because if you're only getting taxed at 20-some percent of what you make, that means you get to keep about 80% of what you make. So you're always trying to make more than, you're not trying to go in the hole. At least I don't know what any businesses are, but it does have that effect. I mean, it does have that effect of the more efficient you are, the more money you make, and your net income is going to be more. And Representative Roper, do you understand that the same way, that it's going to be this $35 isn't industry-wide $35, but it's going to be $35 per company?
I'm sure. I think that's right, but I'm not. You know, I'm certainly. I'm not a member of the Finance Committee, but this is fine tuned up. So, it's a question. I think we should get some feedback on and clear it up for everybody to make sure. So, I think that's how it works. But I'm not going to be. I can't sit here and assure you of that.
Right, and I'm the same way, and I think that that's what we're having this work session for, is so that these issues that we don't quite understand. Representative Kelly, do you have a firmer handle on that for us?
Not necessarily, Mr. Chairman, but once we get to the level of progressivity, we've blown through all the cost recovery. No one argues that. We've already come through all the cost recovery. So we're trying to find a way to capture the value of the commodity that has gone up. And the gross way provides a pure way to do it, because it is not subject to adjustment. It's a pure number, and it measures the delta between the where you trigger it and where you are that on the price, whether it's West Texas or North Slope West or whatever you're measuring, or even wellhead. So I think that the gross way provides a surer way to do it, a simpler way to do it. But if we're building the whole system on the net, there has been good arguments saying we should stick with the net as we're trying to recover increased share in the fact that the commodity has gone up in price. So we could do it either way. We could absolutely do it either way.
And but you don't want to punish somebody that's investing in the state. That's, be very careful of that.
I guess my question is that, you know, PPT is done on a company-wide basis, company-wide profit.
Mm-hmm.
But here we're talking about the point of production of individual fields or individual wells.
We do it all the time right now.
But I don't know how we do point of production when you have a whole bunch of different wells and a bunch of different fields, and then what do you relate the $35 to as far as the tax on the company-wide profits, because you're not taxing the individual well profits, you're taxing the company-wide PPT.
You take each field separately.
Well, we do, but because that's but we're getting rid of that. We're not going to tax
a field basis. So.
Getting rid of it, that's a threshold decision that we haven't talked about.
Well, that, I mean,
I understand that's outside the scope of the conversation, but it's something people ought to contemplate.
Well, I think we need to get back to the theory of the PPT, was it was going to be a company-wide profit on the company, and that was the tax. And I think this is where the question mark with the net comes, is if you're talking about at the point of production, you're talking about, like when we were doing a gross tax, we were talking about each individual field would have its own, you know, you're doing each individual field. Now, supposedly under PPT, we're doing a company-wide profit. Doesn't matter whether you're in Cook Inlet and on the North Slope, it's a company-wide profit, and the allowances are against the entire company-wide profit. And so I guess what we, unless somebody can explain it to me, what we need to ask is our consultants, how do we relate the net point of production to the escalator for PPT?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
That's exactly one of the points that I wanted to kind of bring up, because we had an expert, Daniel Johnston, who proposed that we should have different tax rates on different kinds of fields, that the legacy fields should be taxed differently than Cook Inlet. And we've kind of decided not to do that, but I think that that's really appropriate for us to consider the proposals that he made in April.
I know. It's complex.
Well, I think that, you know, what we're talking about here may be even more than field. I'm not sure point of production on oil is going to be where it goes into the pipe, right?
That's
point of production is where it goes into the pipe. So the net costs from different parts.
Is gas or oil?
Yeah, we're talking oil. First.
I think we need somebody that knows what we're talking about, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I agree.
Dan Dickinson can straighten this out in about 2 minutes. So.
Well, we'll definitely get with the consultants and find out what this is, but I think that...
We'll be lying to Beth for advice.
And everybody should...
You're a finance committee.
I can't find it, though. I'm looking for it.
If we look at those charts again, we'll see that House Resources and House Final were almost identical curves, and one was based on the gross and one was based on the net. So if we find that we struggle with one, we might want to, you know, look at the other if we can't understand. So does anybody else have any other on this issue? Yeah.
Just one thing, Kelly. Mr. Chairman. I think we should, how aggressive we want the progressivity. Whether it's on net or gross, we can adjust that. But I believe that the House finance, the final version that we sent over to the other body was relatively aggressive as far as the family of curves that you see here, but was still very conservative relative to what our consultants were telling us was appropriate. But I guess where I'd like to settle at least is that relative to the aggressiveness of the progressivity that we put in there, that it's appropriate. And that's one of the measurements that we have to make is, was the aggressiveness appropriate? And then if we think we got to go gross or net, I mean, we could debate that, and there are good reasons on either side. But I don't give a rip as long as the number's right that we finally come to. That's where I come down on it. If there's a risk that we can't come to the number, then that's a reason maybe to go to the gross. But I'm more interested in what that curve delivers on that day that we learn that the price went up, and how quickly it comes off of that price as we go down.
And just to remind everybody that House Resources and the House Final were almost identical as far as the progressivity element. House Resources was on the gross, and it was 0.3, but it was deductible against the PBT, so therefore it turned out to be 0.24 effective rate. And the rate that was on the net, which was not deductible, was 0.25. So the gross and the net in House Resources and House Finance turned out to be identical slopes on the line. It just depended on where you had that starting point. So, thanks. Does anybody else have any other questions or comments that they want to make on the progressivity sections?
I just
Representative Berkowitz.
Yeah. Daniel Johnston spent a fair bit of time talking about it, and I think people ought to go back and look at what he suggested in terms of what he thought was appropriate.
And we do have a number of runs from Econ 1 as well that were based on, I think Econ 1's numbers were based on gross. I don't think we have those in your packet here, but we've got them so we can get them to anybody that's interested.
The last ones had the House, final House, if they have the right iteration of it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Cotulli.
And I just want to chime in kind of along the same lines of what Representative Kelly said. I mean, with us going to the net, the problem is you're going to have a higher price to get to the same place where we'd be with the gross. And it is a little riskier in terms of, we're never going to really know all the costs that are going to come out for the net. But just those are my concerns, is how are we really going to tell, what the net is or should be. And if we go that way, it's going to have to be higher because it will actually turn out to be a lower price for us if we don't go higher on it. Take more.
Representative Kelly, I think what I'm hearing you say is you were comfortable with the curves, whether they were the House Resources or House Final, that those two curves that were mirror, one on gross and one on net, you're comfortable with either one of those, but you're...
As long as they deliver.
Yeah.
As long as they deliver, we don't have a problem with coming to the number. The other point is to remember that where we intentionally set the progressivity trigger in both of those bodies, the resources and the finance, was above full cost recovery. So we're not talking about covering costs or, heavy oil, higher costs. We should be above those thresholds. Those threshold points.
And Does anyone have any clarification for me on how using the net adjusts for inflation? I mean, I don't see any adjustment on the takeoff point for inflation by using the net, because that's a fixed increase based on cost.
CapEx and OpEx particularly are going to be accelerating with inflationary numbers. So when you put them in the calculation to get a net figure, they reflected the higher costs per inflationary pressures reflected in the figures you're using at a current point in time. So if this formula is going to exist 10 years from now, it would reflect the cost of that time, not the current cost. Therefore, it's adjusted somewhat for the inflationary pressures. That's how it's a real number, not a set number.
I guess I'm understanding that the net, you know, as costs increase, the net would be less, but the surcharge is based on an increased percent.
What's the surcharge?
Well, that's the takeoff point and then the progressivity.
Oh, I thought that was for the 470 fund, the surcharge.
No, they call it a surcharge.
Oh, they do, I know. Who knows?
But the progressivity, I mean, has been talked about that it incorporates inflationary pressure, but I just don't see how it does, because it's going to be fixed at $35, and that doesn't change as a takeoff point.
The drill bit costs more 10 years from now than it costs today. That's where the answer is.
What
a drill bit costs more 10 years from now than it does today.
Maybe.
Well, I understand. Yeah, but the
maybe
just a second. I understand that, but the question is, how does that influence the progressivity element? I understand that it influences
on net.
The net.
Well, no. All right,
Mr. Chair. But the progressivity increases the net rate that you're going to pay.
What's on the price? I mean, we got about a $15 delta between net and gross right now on ANS West Coast. So it's approximately net range. So you put your operating costs and whatever is allowable under the PPT formulation into the calculation, and you get the net amount. We'll do it for the rest of the entire bill. I mean, so we're going to be doing it back to the wellhead on everything. So we don't have to create a number to do this. It's not going to be a separate exercise per se. We'll have the number. We should have.
Everyone got it?
Thanks. If your drill bit costs more money in 10 years, that's fine. Your costs have gone up. But if the price of oil has gone up by the same amount, your net remains exactly the same of where it was now as it will be in 10 years. It depends too much on what the price of oil will be and how much your operational expenditures or capital expenditures rise. As long as you're keeping track of them,
for sure,
then the net may not be any different ever if things simply go the same.
Could be.
And I think what Representative Seaton is saying is just saying that the costs will go up is not as important as knowing how the costs go up relative to the price. And if we don't know either one, then we're really working on a net that we know today and a net that we're guessing at in the future. But at least we're saying that given this set of circumstances, this is an appropriate taxing mechanism for net.
No, Mr. Chairman, I just say as a business person, you don't want to tax somebody else that's losing money or bleeding to death. You don't want to increase their taxes. That's my point.
Right.
Don't go on gross, go on net.
The difference between the two is as prices go up and expenses go up, and if we start taxing only the gross, we'll always be taxing higher.
Whether they're making money or not.
Well, even if they're in the same category of the difference between the expenses and the price of oil, as long as that delta remains the same, but the gross is going to keep going up when that happens. And we'll be increasing our tax revenue even though the net didn't change. So there's a mechanism for increasing tax revenue as the gross goes up, and the question is that fair? That's really the only question that's left. Do you want to do that? Or do you want to stick with the net because that's more appropriate?
Representative Berkowitz?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the frustrations I've had during the course of this debate is it's shifted to a discussion of fundamentally an income tax instead of a discussion about how much are we going to sell our oil for. And if they're making more money off of our oil, it seems only fundamentally fair that we make more money along with them. And the way you do that is you stay on the gross. Now, I don't want to tie the state's share of selling our commodity to someone else making a profit, because that's what we're talking about. Somewhere in this equation, that discussion of oil, there has to be the recognition that it is Alaska's oil that is being sold on the market, and that the oil companies that we're letting through our leases sell our oil and make a profit off it. As their profits go up, that means the value of our commodity has gone up, and we should get more for the value of our commodity.
That's what we do.
Well, just to back up a little bit, our progressivity is based on price, not on their relative profits. Now, if their relative profits are based on price, then the increase goes up. But, you know, just trying to figure out how this really works as far as on net, it doesn't matter how much money they made, if the price is $60, then there is going to be an amount of progressivity that's built into that. And it doesn't matter whether their profit is high or low, that progressivity amount is still the same. Because what it's done is increased the tax rate, and that's over at the left-hand side. The effective tax rate has been increased by the progressivity, and it doesn't matter what their profits are. Even though it's based on net, if you look at the chart and take a price and go over to the left-hand side, that's talking about effective tax rate. And it doesn't matter what their profit has been, whether they've been an efficient company or an inefficient company. If you look at the effective average tax rate and price levels, so I think that we need to get some real definition on that, because that's one of the things that have been proposed is why net is good, is because it somehow includes inflation. And it does, but the progressivity that's built on price doesn't have anything to do with inflationary costs. The progressivity, whether it's based on, because it's only based on the price of oil, not on, it doesn't matter whether you build it on the net. What it is you're increasing the amount of tax rate that you're going to charge on the net income, or you're increasing the tax surcharge that you can take on gross, but it really, that doesn't matter what their net income is, whether it's high or low, it's still, progressivity is still there based on the price. So anyway, we'll ask those two questions then and see if we can get somebody to give us the answer of how net is supposed to adjust for inflationary pressure. Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, and what we attempted to do as far as the net went, when we set the number at 35, we did exactly the reverse. You're right. We did the WTI or the ANS West, we let float on the gross. That has a That does move the ceiling up as possible. When we froze the net 35, when we use that as a surrogate for backing out the cost, I think what we did is, just as you say, we stopped that from moving relative to cost. It doesn't move itself. So I think it's going to be important how we ask that question.
Yeah.
What answer we get.
Mr. Chair, start with
an important part of this discussion. Important part of this discussion that we brought up yet is how much investment we're trying to have happen back into Alaska. How many jobs are going to be created into Alaska? You know, that directly affects that gross bringing into net. So, you know, let's look at part two of this: is how much money we want to invest back into Alaska, how many jobs we want created in Alaska, and that's, I think, what I haven't heard part of this discussion yet.
And Representative Newman, I think that's on the credit part.
Well, it's on the credit that affects your growth.
Yeah.
No, it's in the progressivity, too, in my opinion.
Yes.
That's why we're doing that.
Okay. That's exactly why we're doing that.
Did we beat this horse to death? Let's go to issue two. What are the effects of the two-thirds gas revenue exclusion? Those are called the GREs in the Senate bill, what is the effect of the one-third for the North Slope, one-half for south of the Brooks, or two-thirds gas revenue exclusion in the House? And you do have a sheet there. It's kind of a written out sheet from Robin Wilson based on here. If everybody finds this one here, it looks like this, handwritten at the top and all. And I guess, you know, the question here became awesome. As to what that was doing, and that was in the Senate bill at one-third, only taxing one-third of the gas, or that two-thirds gas revenue exclusion, or the three different ones in the House. This chart here is explaining what the two-thirds gas revenue exclusion means as far as if you're a gas producer and you have the $12 million credit, which is, remember, the $12 million credit was an allowance equal to $60 million of production before you paid any petroleum profits tax. And as you can see here by Robin's calculations, if you go to the far right hand side, that's $240 million. So you come that a third of that is $80 million, and then you subtract basically 8% costs, which is, according to Dan Dixon, a little low. You come out with a net of 61. And so your $12 million credit would basically just offset $240 million worth of gas if what you are is a gas producer. And, you know, there was some question. I don't think that we have analyzed it fully. At least I didn't realize what the whole thing meant. And so I don't know if other people have questions on that or not, but we had started out with the governor's bill that had a $73 million exclusion, and that $73 million exclusion now is $240 million with the way the Senate bill does a two-thirds gas exclusion rate. And I don't think that anybody had really identified that. I don't know. Had you in finance identified that was the effect of that gas exclusion rate?
Well,
that
it was 18, 20, 15.
Yeah.
Well, we modified that in the House bill.
In the House bill, we modified somewhat, but I wasn't there. I was there for some of the finance, but I wasn't there for that. And did you guys talk about that it was going to effectively exclude $240 million of revenue from every company before they started paying any profits tax, petroleum profits tax?
Yeah. Well, there was some discussion of that.
We did, and it was the econ one. It was, I think, Dr. Finizza who, and I think Representative Roekberg's got the chart.
He gave us
where it was, yeah, it was pretty dramatic in terms, especially when you hit lower oil prices, of how much money the state would lose. I mean, the administration came in very strongly on that issue as well, against it.
Again?
Mm-hmm. Well,
Pedro Van Meers has got a new Pedro's got nothing out in favor of it.
So. I'm sorry. I misspoke. I'm forgetting which one it was that they were against. But, yeah, Econ 1 did the runs on this and showed how much the state lost if it was only effectively taxing one-third.
But it was wrapped into the gas contract at some point, too.
Well, it depended on whether you were in Prudhoe or whether you were other North Slope, or whether
it's
you were
not
south
in the gas.
As far as the impact,
the effect of it is,
but not in the not Senate version. The Senate version was one third anywhere, excluded two thirds of gas anywhere in the state.
Right, you've got that.
Okay, and I guess the other thing that you know, that this brings up, you know, there was difference in the Senate version and the House version, that you also have this Barry Pulliam memo here. And if you notice down in the bottom there, this is the analysis of a 6 TCF field with 300 million barrels of condensate, which is treated as oil. And if you look at that summary there, it says, in order to argue that the proposed gas exclusion will give a state an effective tax rate of approximately 7%, one must also accept that the effective tax rate on oil from such a field will be much smaller. In Dr. Van Muir's example, it is 3% over the life of the field. So that's a 3% PPT instead of a 21.5 or whatever on oil PPT. And, you know, if you look through that, the reason is because all of the costs are shifted to the oil production.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, had you guys looked at it that way too?
Well,
yeah.
Mr. Chairman, the changes that we proposed in the House, where we changed the slope to the two-thirds, and the other, the Cook Inlet south of the range to 0.5 and the Cook Inlet to a third, was because of the Econ 1 output, where they told us that, you know, what you just said about the one-third exclusion, but they said it would be more appropriate to apply those different values. I'm not sure that went all the way to solving the problem, but that's what the amendments that I proposed were about, try to make that less severe. And we in fact included that in the House version, but whether that went all the way or not, and to your point about the 100% on the credits, I don't think we're there yet. I think we need some more help, some more information on that.
Okay. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I think just for people to understand it right now, what we passed in the House version, as Representative Kelly points out, was an equivalency of the two-thirds on the slope and one-half with Representative Kelly's amendment on all other areas besides Cook Inlet below the Umiak baseline and one-third in the inlet. And basically, it was Representative Kelly that wanted to raise the tax elsewhere. That's like all frontier areas, excluding a ring fence around Cook Inlet Basin and north of the 6815. So what that did was raise it, frankly, and raise the amount of the GRE in other areas. Now, the conventional wisdom proved to be right as far as what the rate was for the North Slope. The approximate 7.25 is represented by the one-third calculate or the two-third calculation on the slope. Therefore, it was basically moot as to what's going to happen if you're a buyer of what they call firm transportation or FT, or you're in the gas line deal. What the administration is offering us, they presented this on the 12th of May, is the uniform upstream fiscal contract, which will be for other producers on the North Slope, and they'll be presenting a bill next Monday on this. They gave us a presentation on this, which is kind of an outline, the other day. So the question I have is, how do we reconcile this particular legislation with the PPT, and if we haven't already done that? I mean, so that's a question that people of interest should ask.
I've got an answer.
Oh, well, that'd be happening.
President Berkowitz.
This is just don't do gas now. There's no gas that we're selling. Why are we putting together a new fiscal regime for gas when we're fundamentally not selling gas outside of Cook Inlet?
Well, that's the thing. If the frontier areas and Cook Inlet would you know, if the question is policy-wise, should we address that or not? I have, I believe, in Cook Inlet with my amendment that we adopted on the House floor, then Representative Kelly's basically addressed it by putting in 50% for severance tax elsewhere in the state.
But if we don't talk about gas at all in an oil tax structure, at least the one we're discussing for the next couple of months, God, that sounds horrifying. but if we don't deal with gas, then all these issues that are related to what the appropriate structure is go away. And we don't have any gas now. So to me, there's something a little bit of an exercise in the absurd that we're trying to concoct this great scheme for how we're going to dispose of our gas when we're not moving any yet.
Reverend Gatto.
Yeah, philosophically, what I got from some of the hearings we've been going to is the enormous amount of gas that exists worldwide at Tidewater by countries such as Indonesia, Qatar, Australia, that have access to liquefaction facilities and will simply put this gas out to sea. If indeed they have as much as has been reported to us, and that's certainly believable, that's our competition. If we don't deal with gas, we're really leaving the gas stranded forever because we won't be able to compete with companies that already get long-term contracts wherever they can. And believe me, if I was Qatar with not 35 trillion cubic feet, but over 1,000 trillion cubic feet at Tidewater, I would be buying tankers like crazy because no one can compete with them. Nobody. Not at $2 an hour labor, not at an infinite amount of gas, not sitting at Tidewater, and not with the plants already in place. If we don't deal with the gas now, well, we may not be able to.
We don't need to deal with it now because we don't have any gas to move. It is, I believe, the term that the administration calls it, stranded. I think they're wrong, but they're calling it stranded. So we don't have any gas, number one. Number two is, as a resource-selling state, if we engage in a race to the bottom with our prices, we will be beaten. There is always going to be somebody who sells it cheaper than we will. And I don't think we want to engage in a race to the bottom. We have attributes that Qatar and Indonesia don't have. We have political stability. We have fiscal stability. We're selling American gas and American oil to an American market, and there's a premium attached to it. So we don't need to race these guys to the bottom. We need to make sure that we're getting, as Alaskan representatives, get full value for our commodity so that the people of the state, when it's being severed from the state, enjoy the benefits.
Well, and just bringing back one more point here, we do need to look at how the gas exclusion, gas revenue exclusion, and whether it's the 7% in the contract or whether it's the 7%. You know, that was in the Senate bill, or it would be 14% probably, and as on the slope as the amendment that Representative Kelly passed. I guess what we're trying to do also is look at the effect of that on oil. What is the effect on the oil PPT and the you know, the Pulliam's Barry Pulliam's memo here is saying that on this kind of a field. It would be devastating on taxes on oil, meaning we're going to give away the oil without any. Basically, we're only going to have 3% PPT over the life of the field on oil. And basically, by doing this, we have a huge effect on our oil taxes. And so, I guess that's my concern, is that what we've done is. You know, the argument when we were in resources, and several people here were at the resources, is we were saying, okay, gas and oil are going to be together so we don't have to allocate costs. They're both together. They're both in PPT. You do this, you just write off the costs. But then we came along and we did this gas revenue exclusion, which basically did that and allocated all the costs to oil and took the gas for free. And two-thirds of it for free. And so it seems like that, you know, if we'd been considering this at the first, as far as the gas this gas exclusion, we would have probably been into a situation of saying we need to allocate the costs to gas and allocate the cost to oil because it according to this memo from Econ One, from Barry, it really skews our oil taxes if we do it. So, if does anybody else understand this any better than I do? I think we need to have them come in and give a presentation to.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the conclusions are exactly correct as you stated them, but I mean, this is very confusing. This particular example in the memorandum you're referring to, the email, is based on a Point Thompson-like field, so it's got a small amount of condensate vis-a-vis a large amount of gas. So what the effects are, we knew even from the other runs that Econ One had done, which is Mr. Pulliam's, but those type of things could happen, but that's not necessarily always the case. I mean, I can look through here under what we've got here and look at anywhere from 6 to 12% returns under different scenarios here. So, and this one I have, it doesn't even have the house elements here. It has a 22.5, 25. So, I mean, we're working off of bad numbers. We need to get them updated.
Okay.
And find out what we're doing. And I think the issue here is, and what Representative Berkowitz is talking about, I would disagree with him in the sense that, in part, that one reason we're working on this now is that back in my hometown, we need gas. And we have to address this right now. We can't wait for something to happen. And we have areas like in the Indiana Basin, the Bristol Bay, other prospective areas that we need to look at and include, and this is a law of general applicability. So we need to make sure we have a statewide tax system in place for both oil and gas, and if that requires excluding the North Slope for gas, as the good representative mentions, maybe that's a policy call because it's taken care of otherwise, or if we pass these other bills. So it's a chicken and egg thing. So if we're going to do a law of general applicability, I would suggest that we need to have those.
Okay, and I think that we really need Barry or somebody to really come in here and explain this well to us and do some other runs, and I think that maybe that's the best deal, and then get back together again and see where this all falls out. Yeah,
I just would like to make comments, Chairman, because I have to take off here, but. There's some discussion about the amendment I made regarding Cook Inlet and what this GRE is. It's what they call it, gas.
Revenue exclusion.
Revenue exclusion. Another acronym, right, we have to do in the poor public. But just so people understand this, by applying the GRE, even at one-third, makes a pretty substantial exclusion of costs and potential taxes to gas production to Cook Inlet. I mean, you can make a case that almost zeros it out. And that being the case, it's possible a number of years down there if we have very high gas, however. And don't forget, this January, Henry Hub prices were north of $15 at LCF. That it's conceivable that we would be in a situation where we would be charging taxes and kick in Cook Inlet taxes. And what my amendment did was put a sunset on increases that could be passed along to consumers for a 15-year period, that being the period which we could explore. And, I mean, that would be the earliest potential time of any spur line from the slope coming into the Cook Inlet region, which affects 474,000 people in the whole rail belt area. So there was intended to be two different things. That's why Representative Kelly's and my bill got interrelated by happenstance, not design, because of this GRE situation and how it interrelated with that. I mean, there's ways you can handle that. If the legislature felt that the GRE was not appropriate and deleted that, we could leave my language in place, or we could do vice versa if that was a policy call. But I mean, this group understands there's a relationship, but they are disconnected.
Yeah, and your bill and your amendment that was adopted works whether this gas revenue exclusion is there or not.
That's
because yours caps at existing average.
Right, not to exceed the current ELF calculation.
Right, but caps it at or the current the trailing 12-month average, I believe.
Right.
That's correct.
It set the benchmark.
Yeah.
And then it did establish it under the same calculation for a new entry into the basin.
Right. Yeah, it seems to me that that makes a lot of sense to do it that way.
It was simple.
More than the gas revenue exclusion, which has a lot of ramifications on cost shifting and cost allowances and a whole bunch of other factors. So.
Yeah, just for the information, the present Cook Inlet producers are paying $33.6 million a year in severance taxes currently. And, so that was the thrust and the basis of the calculation that I suggested and adopted by the House. So just so people understand that there is a relationship, but they're not the same.
Great. And I think that works to fix that without having to have the exclusion affect everything else. Yeah. Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I think your point is a good one, that we need to get some help on this and follow through. But one of the points to what Representative Berkowitz was saying about the two systems, we've heard quite a bit that they want one regime so they don't have two completely separate methods and of calculation. And I'm really not sure whether that is significant or just an inconvenience, but that might be one of the things to find out, because we've been told that the net regime versus the gross regime, or sticking with the ELF gas and just letting gas go for now, mm-hmm. in other than the contract areas, leaves them stuck with the old system and the new system as well. So we probably should find out, is that a serious question,
10%.
Or is that just a small matter?
Representative Berkowitz?
I've got to dig into it again, but there's sections in the bill, as I recall, where there is apportionment between oil and gas, and I'll dig those out and share those. But I think the point also that a lot of, I guess it's in response to...
Just a moment. In the bill, are you talking about the PPT or are you talking about the gas? I'm trying to guess.
PPT.
Okay.
I mean, there's apportionment that's included in those pages. But, the concern that Representative Gatto has that somehow we're going to be left behind, I think, is overcome if you think that there's going to be a gas contract that's going to sort of supersede anything we legislate. So that ought to put your concern to rest.
Karen, do you have something? Sure. Okay. Representative Newman, did you have a... Representative Newman, did you have...
No.
Okay.
No.
Just saying, I want to make sure anybody... There's several of us, including myself, monopolizing too much conversation here. I want to make sure that there's no one else that wants to. So is there anybody? Representative Lynn?
We'll speak up.
Okay. So, Representative Kelly?
Just a comment on the 0.5 and the two-thirds that we did to capture the Yukon Flats, Bristol Bay, Nenana Basin at the 0.5 and the two-thirds on other than the contract slope areas. That was a method of trying to make sure that we had something that would send the folks into the field. But at the same time, if they stuck their finger into 3 or 4 TCF in one of those areas, that we had some tax better than just a one-third. So that was not what we did there is took something that Econ 1 generated and put that in place in that amendment. But that was an attempt to do, is say that the one-third may work for Cook Inlet, but it might not be appropriate for those other areas.
I know that Senator
Reverend Berkowitz.
Yeah, Senator Gass ran, and you put her analytical skills to work and got together with all the experts and came up with a gas system for everything off the slope. So statewide, everything off the slope. And y'all might want to take a look at that, too.
Okay, we've got questions asked on that one. On number 3, down here, issue 3, what is the effect of the $25 million per company direct rebate on transferable tax credits? That was an issue we had in the House. The Senate doesn't have anything on that, and I know Representative or Senator Wilkins brought up that in the debate as one of the things that he was concerned about. Does anybody have any comments on that one? Just to recap of where we are is the administration came forward with a bill that said, okay, we want to have transferable tax credits for losses, loss carryforwards, because those people, explorers, didn't have any production to write off their credits against. And so those were made as transferable credits that could then be sold to anyone else that had production, and they could write it off up to 20% of their tax bill by buying these transferable credits. Some of the concerns of the small independents were that they could really get squeezed by the majors that had, because there was only one place to sell the credits, and that was somebody else that had production tax credit. There had been proposals to allow them to write that off against their income taxes and other things, and the philosophy was that we want to protect the state's other revenue sources, and so there was never in any committee any consideration of allowing those transferable credits to be written off against any other form of tax other than the production tax. In resources, we said, well, you know, it could be that they could get squeezed. Let's say the majors were only going to pay 70% because they would have to hold them for a year because they had already written off their too many of their credits, and so they might be paying a very small amount. And what we're trying to do is get the dollars back to the people that were actually putting the investment in the ground. That's the small independents that had these losses that were then converted into trading their credits. And so in resources, we decided to do a $10 million per company direct rebate. And then I think in House Finance, that got up to $25 million per company. And the only problem is that the way the language is, it says the commissioner shall do these rebates. And at low prices, where we don't have production tax coming in, we would still have to rebate those direct credits for those losses from all those companies, and that was the debate. Now, the Senate does not have anything that allows direct rebate from the state for those transferable credits. And so that's just recapping the issue for everybody, is that's why there is this issue and there's this difference. Is the original 2020 PT came with this transferable credits as a way to protect the state on the downside from having to kick out credits when we didn't have money coming in. And over the course of time, that got changed to a $25 million direct rebate per company. And so it's House and Senate is, House has $25 million, there's nothing in the Senate. And I guess that's another issue that we have here to discuss as to whether we want to look at that. And, you know, I had an amendment that didn't get adopted that allowed the another buyer, and the buyer that I identified was the ARM board to come in.
It's because it wasn't UAF or something.
We could do it with the permanent fund instead if people don't like the, you know, the ARM board, but that does give the protection for the state. And I don't know whether anybody's interested in looking at that. We don't have the folks in the Senate here to tell us their perspective, but I hope that people will talk with their senators and find out what their perspective on that issue is on the direct refundable credits, because we probably need to work that out before we go further. Yeah,
I really like that idea, in that it allowed the ARM board to do something. Didn't compel them, it allowed them. So they would make this decision, based on, you know, if we buy it, was it 90%, 92%, 92%, we buy it at 92%, wow, we can make 8% that quickly. But that's their decision. We have people that get paid a reasonable amount of money to make investment decisions, as opposed to the fact that who would the only other buyer be? And would they do it for only that percent? Or would they say, I think we got you where we want you? So I really like that, but it failed anyway, even though it was only permissive. And that surprised me. I'd like to see that up again with given the opportunity with the same explanation. But
well, and it was probably a more complicated explanation. What it's doing is just putting one more buyer out there for the transferable credits. And but it established a floor as well, so that the small companies knew they could get at least 92%. But they didn't have to sell. If one of the three majors was going to pay them 95 or 97%, obviously they would sell to there. But, you know, like I say, if people were uncomfortable with the ARM board, even though the Commissioner of Revenue is one of the ARM board members and has to approve, you know, the way the language was, has to approve that the economic situation is such that the state could fund, you know, the state was in a position to do that. But the Senate bill didn't have any direct rebate at all. So if like I say, if people were uncomfortable with the ARM board and wanted it to be the permanent fund board, you know, or some other mechanism, so that we got rid of the liability of having to have the direct refunds in low oil prices, that's a possibility too. But we need to talk with the Senate and find out what their comfort level is on direct refund rebates. But I know it was identified by Representative Wilkins as one of the things that they had never seen before, and he wasn't willing to go there at that time. So, Representative Kelly.
Just a comment. I think where that may have, and I was with you on that that amendment, I think where it may have come to grief in the House was we were getting the Representative Kapsner energy plan. We were getting the Ramos, Representative Ramos had a charitable contribution check off, and we had the ARM board. And I think people just went, wait a minute, this is a PPT thing, and it was less related to the merits, measuring the merits of the individual amendments than it was to, wait a minute, this is a tax bill. And so I think we, at least we need to consider that may have been part of why that fell upon grief as well.
Yeah. And it could have been, it was 2:30 or 3 in the morning too. Representative Kurtula.
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it, actually, that time. One of my concerns, I like the idea as well, because it's, you know, ultimately would save the state money at some point, and it would also have another buyer, as you're saying. But one of the other concerns I had, and we talked about this in finance, and ultimately, given the time of the morning, didn't run the amendment, but I think that similar to the $12 million on the base allowance, that there should be some limit on how far into the future the credits can go. Because right now, these are just rolling credits, and in a down year, you know, when you see enough of the credits come home to roost, the state could wind up in some trouble. And we did get that testimony in finance. Dan Dickinson confirms that is a concern. So I think that we should look at, you know, the way that we structured that $12 million credit base in the bill and flesh that out a little bit more as well, so that there's some kind of ability for the state to plan ahead and you aren't always facing this rolling situation ad infinitum. And I liked the part that allowed the small companies, the explorers, to come in and be able to take part in the base credit, because that pushed it out for them to whenever it is that they actually got something, so they were allowed to partake in it. But there's a limit on those credits, whereas with these, there's no time limit. And I think that's just something that we do need fleshed out.
You're talking about the transferable credits. Yeah, because the base allowance credits have to be used that year.
That's right. There's a time limit. They're 10 years for that, yeah.
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
My recollection of the discussion on the House floor was that this was somewhat afield of the core bill, and there was a suggestion that it really would require some careful study in a committee. And I can see, listening now, that there's merit to this, but I see also that it is something that's fairly complex and a little bit different than the rest of the bill. You might want to consider if this or something like this passes, then having it as a separate standalone bill next year that the committees could really take a look at.
And I think what we're trying to do is figure out, we've got Senate language that says no refundable credits. We've got $25 million per company, mandatory refundable credits from the state in our bill, and trying to find some kind of a common ground to a solution to this issue might be something like this, but we'll need to get talking to some other folks as well. So, but I take the suggestion, Representative Brokert.
I think what you need, perhaps if I could suggest, you need to decide what the public policy is here. If you want to expand the market and availability of funding for smaller independents or those that have difficulty finding a buyer and guaranteeing them, at least you're going to set a floor if you went to the 92%. So, I mean, I have grave concerns about doing that, quite frankly. I think the real issue here is whether you want to protect the cash flow of the state's revenue stream and low prices. Now, those are two different goals entirely. So you need to identify what your goal is, and then if you're going to go with the protection of the revenue stream, which I call the piling on or the pig piling issue, then you should focus on that. And you can do that by capping certain things, like capping the amount in dollar terms or capping on the price of oil, or there's various different methodologies you can use to protect the state's revenue stream. I think that's what perhaps that's reflected by the Senate, because they had none, you know, in terms of that. So I think there was one other, I think House Finance had a $40 a barrel on another issue that, I don't know, was a little bit artful, that might work or something.
House Resources had a $40 per barrel oil cap on credit. I believe it was on $10 million, I think it was on our $10 million refundable credits. I think that we had was only allowable if the price of oil was over $40 a barrel.
Something like that.
But that didn't stay in the finance version. The finance version is the state shall refund $25 million per company.
Yeah, we also, the House Finance Committee removed they put a 50,000 barrel cap too on the allowance. So those amount of created credits were decreased, right?
It was in there, but it really was meaningless because
the big three don't get the 12 million annualized.
Well, that's different than the tradable credits, because the tradable credits are only available for loss carry forward. And if you got 50,000 barrels of production, you're not probably going to have a loss carry forward.
Right.
And the tradable credits are only generated by loss carry forward by the small explorers and small producers that have the loss carry forward.
I'll try a low price oil, like I've seen it here. You might have a lot of loss carry forward. Yeah.
Well, and I'm not sure we would want the $25 million.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, that's the point. That should be the policy. If you're going to be worried about that, and you should be, then that's where you need to modify.
And that's a good suggestion to come forward with. You get it again. let's go on to the issue for the offset of 5,000 barrels per day, capped at $14 million in the Senate, versus what's the effect of the $12 million credit base allowance in the House. Does anybody have any good handle on the differences between that 5,000 barrel capping at $14 million versus the $12 million credit in the House? I mean, obviously at it's capped at 14 million. So if prices were high, 5,000 barrels a day was going to, you know, generate a lot of money, but it was capped at 14. So it's capped at a little higher than the houses. I'm not sure what the downside and the normal. Is anybody familiar with the Senate version and what they, the 5,000 barrels per day? And that seems to be quite different. You know, it's both looking at the base allowance, but I think we need some more people to explain those differences to us, because I'm not up to it.
Sounds like
it. So okay, so we'll just ask a question on that to have somebody come in and see if they can explain this. Yeah, Representative Grimberg.
As we wind this down, I have been asked by actually Representative Guerra to maybe get some research on some other issues too. I'd like to tack on at the end here.
Okay, let's get through number five here first, and that is, what's the effect of page 22, line 11 through 13? And in the House bill, we have this provision that the expenses does not need to be physically located on or near the lease. And that is the allowance for overhead. So if you look at the House version, page 22.
This is amended House.
Amended House, yeah. Page 22, lines 11 through 13. Oops. Maybe it is.
That version B.
See a Senate bill. Finance. Oh, yeah.
You did the amendment on this.
We have this amendment in the, but you did that in finance?
We did, but Representative Gardner was going to have it on the House.
On the floor, but in the wee hours. We just didn't do it.
Just the mercy.
Oh, you were going to take it out.
Outsourcing. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, we don't have it in the Senate version, and we have it in the House version. And so it's one of those, again.
It's an AOGA amendment. It was an AOGA amendment.
It's one of those issues that needs to be probably addressed and looked at. And so it does give us some differences here, because all of a sudden, if it doesn't need to be physically located on the premises and there's no, it can be in London.
Well,
it can be in Qatar, it can be
anywhere.
It can be wherever.
Mars.
And Mr. Chair,
yes, sir.
I think we heard from more than one expert that the only way that the net profit taxes really should work is if the ingredients of the net profit are really carefully defined. And this is something that just leaves it wide open without any opportunity for Alaskan auditors to confirm or deny the costs.
Representative Kelly, were you involved with the conversation that put that where this came from? Do you know?
Yep. Mr.
Okay.
Not.
You know. Representative Gatto.
Is it possible that you could interpret this to say that every member, every single employee of a corporation is part of their cost? And certainly to some degree can be charged, if not all of it, against the profits here.
Need to get an expert.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that the problem here is that we're just opening for litigation. You know, that's one of the things that we've been told is you need to have these things defined well. I mean, where we had the costs as came out of House Finance, I mean House Resources, everything was tied to the lease, and it's, you know, it's not here. So, I'm not sure. Yes, Representative Grimberg?
I think we'd be well advised to either take it out entirely or limit it in some manner.
Okay. Anyway, do Representative Lynn, do you have any feelings on these costs not having to be on or near the premises of the lease property?
Yeah, I think the closer the better. One of the problems I've had with this thing is, if we can write out something over there for something that's happening here, it just leaves it wide open.
Okay. And we'll see if we can find out from somebody else why, if there's a good reason to have this in, a good explanation. But otherwise, I think that I'm hearing from around this discussion group that people would like to make sure that we don't open litigation doors and so tighten it up to... And I believe that what everything was being done was costs on a, when it's on the lease. Like if you bring a rig in, as soon as it's on the lease property, it classifies as capital expenditures, is what we were told in House Resources. And this means that when the rig is being built in Louisiana, you would be taking the capital costs at that time instead of waiting until it got to Alaska. And so I guess we,
China.
It doesn't look like there's any disagreement, at least among this group. So we'll talk to some other folks. Yeah.
It seems to me, Grimmer, you've got to read this in conjunction with the portion of sub 2 on page 21, commencing line 31, and going to the top of page 22, because this is... modify that, but what it does is it gives the department, I believe the Department of Revenue, to publish regulations on the subject, and the question is the amount of discretion you're giving the Commissioner of Revenue here, because certainly if under the statute they have that authority, then they wouldn't be able to litigate it, probably, but it's a matter of public policy if you want to limit his authority.
Representative Kudula?
Well, Representative Grimberg put his finger on second concern about this. The department's testimony was that actually this is in the bill already, and they were just getting a little bit more clear about their statement. So I think, you know, we could take that section out, which is sort of the easy fix, but we actually do have to be concerned about going the next step into the bill if we want to spell it out that we don't want to allow those costs to be deducted at the time that something's made in China or that the whole team's in London, something like that. It's going to take one more layer, I think, to fix. But
So Representative Cartula, are you suggesting that we can just change this to an activity instead of saying does not need to be physically located on or near, it must be located
near. I'm not sure exactly how to fix that part, but I think it does have to go to the next level. We could get to the part of taking the one section out. That was clear, you know, as fast as we were going. But then I think there's another level there of the onion that we would have to fix, and I think it's worthwhile to do it.
Mr. Chair, this is just an example of one small issue that's fairly complex that shows the care we need to take with this whole thing.
Okay, I think we're at least this work group is identifying that we're kind of more with the Senate on that than our language, but I understand what you mean. We need to define it. We'll ask for what we need to do to get to where we want to go and make sure it's very clear. Representative Lynn and then Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I shared this with you earlier before we actually gaveled in, but I found the presentation made at Centennial Hall quite helpful because we're not seeing, I had not signed the confidentiality agreement, so I'm very happy to see that. And I've had several reactions to it. Obviously, there's several challenges. See there, and along the line, most people know that I do have a blog. I try to update it every so often, and I just updated one here, and it's entitled Challenges, and I've identified at least six challenges. I try to identify them, what they are, and I have some comments on that. So I invite anybody who wants to at least see my perspective on anything to go to my blog, and you can find that through the legislative site. It's the easiest way to do it. So I think these are challenges I see that need to be addressed before we can get this pipeline contract started and the gas flowing at some future date. So I just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention.
Okay. And then it was Representative Gardner.
I think that it's
commonly understood that one of the biggest hindrances to investment is access to facilities, and the PPT doesn't begin to address that. So we can talk a lot about having incentives and having credits and this and that, but if explorers who find the resource they're looking for can't get access to the facilities, it does them no good. And I think that that's something we need to be really looking at, that the bill doesn't.
And let's see. We, you know, this was just the initial cut of issues that I typed up after talking to a number of members around the Centennial Hall about what issues they wanted to see addressed. There was one more on that page 22, as long as we're there. There's this line 26, a reasonable allowance is determined under regulations for overhead expenses. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how comfortable people are with no limitation or with just allowing that overhead expenses.
Mr. Chairman, could we get you a list? I'm sorry we've been so wound up with the gas, but could we just get you a list? We could get you a list of some of the definition sections in particular, because we did go through and work on those in finance, even though I think I got at least a couple votes on those. But they really are of concern in terms of what happens if you haven't defined things like overhead.
We count those as moral victories.
Let's see if there's some more issues that we want to get on the, at least on the table here, so that we can be talking about them in the future. And you've got a list. Let me get Representative Kelly. He had one here, and then Representative Grimper.
One general issue is making sure, and this has come up from time to time as we've gone along, but making sure that we fully understand, as between gas and oil, and the impact, you know, when we've got them separated, that we don't get ambushed by the credits. Mm-hmm. I think that general area is one that we have not had enough folks sit in that chair and go to the board and say, okay, this is exactly how this is going to work. Because we did have, you know, I think we solved the what we referred to as the gold plating issue and the triple dip issue, and I think we've solved some of those, but I'm wondering about the ones we didn't solve. So if I just had to put a general category of nervousness, it would be in this how the credits touch down issue, really calculate them, and then what are some of the worst cases where credits are applied, maybe gained on gas, applied on oil, and just exactly how all of those crossovers work, so we make sure we aren't creating a situation where accidentally, no one's intention to we get an ambush.
Okay. Representative Sisson.
I have a concern which I don't think, and I haven't gone to many of your meetings, this committee's meetings, but I have a concern that I haven't heard discussed. It wasn't discussed much with the initial development of Prudhoe Bay, but I think we actually are feeling the effects of it even today, and that's the social costs of these kinds of developments. And why I think it's important, I don't know how it fits into this discussion, but I know it's part of it, but I don't hear it, and that is, there's going to be an enormous effect by the amount of publicity that this project has been given and what it's going to look like to the rest of the country to have these enormous amounts of jobs that are available here. With us, with our PFDs and with our expanded social programs, we didn't have. In the 1970s, when we didn't have all those extra things, there was waves of people who came here loading their carts with their kids and arriving and then not having services, but nonetheless a wait. They got low-paid jobs and they stayed because they couldn't leave. And that is going to be a feature that's a bigger problem now than it was then. If we don't think about that, if we don't look at what do we do to try to offset those kinds of problems, or at least build in some kinds of ways to make sure that we're preparing for that. I think it's part of this discussion, and it's part of what Representative Berkowitz was talking about in terms of we've got to think about this in terms of the people of the state of Alaska. We're focusing everything right now on oil and gas, and we've got to think about what impact does this have on the people of Alaska, because that's what we're doing it for.
It almost sounds like an immigration issue. Maybe we get put the National Guard on the border out there, kind of keep all these folks out.
We don't want to.
Representative Guerra had made some suggestions that I'd like to have us have some research on. These are from Dan Johnson's memo to us. And actually some modeling, whether the various rates on Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, whether that should be higher than the North Slope exploration, and then Cook Inlet. When you're sending, are you going to be asking for some additional research to be done on some of these things? Because otherwise I can just ask House Research to do it.
I think House Research would be good to do that, because the difference here is we've got to either go back to doing field by field, which is a rewrite of the whole philosophy of the bill for the DPT, if we're doing field by field analysis. And, you know, we can do that, but Daniel Johnson has provided, you know, a fair amount. And Daniel, you know, the one thing that he said was that this PPT worked well under the constraints that it had to be designed. And the design constraint was that it's supposed to be one tech that applies across all of Alaska per company. And so that's where we came out with the bill, the whole philosophy that's been presented.
I realize and where we're going. A different philosophy. So, I'm just sort of going through the list that Les had suggested, and then dealing with the level of the progressivity. We have not gone anywhere near the 0.375 that Johnston had suggested above the $40 per barrel. Those were two of the issues he had suggested. A third issue dealt with the whether there should be a requirement of a working interest owners to provide at a commercially reasonable rate of return not to exceed 10% access to these facilities, and this is what Representative Gardner was talking about too.
Is that in Daniel Johnson's paper?
No, that isn't. Oh. It was in some a version that an amendment that he had prepared that did not get adopted. And fourth had to do with the reforms on some additional forms on the ELF proposal, and I'm not intimately familiar with those. You guys,
the record's clear. It was Representative Krutula's facilities access amendment.
It was Amendment 10.
Amendment 10. Okay, Representative Kelly.
Just one other thing, and I know we've brought this up before, and we've fooled with it a bit, but it's the whole idea of a floor.
Yeah.
We, you know, investment is incented by price above all other things. We know that, and we don't want to harm investment. But as we get down into the lower prices, and if we're hung there for a while, I still think that's one of those things out there that whether it's going to get any legs or not is another matter. But if we were looking at things that we might want to at least have a look at as we go through the gate here. That was another one.
There were some amendments on the floor too.
There was a problem in that they got loud stuff around 2:30 a.m. Disconnected.
And one thing that I was looking at when I was kind of preparing for here was that you know, it was like, well, we don't have any model for doing that. We don't have anything. And yet we have in the bill 5% gross royalty for private royalty holders. The tax rate is 5% of the gross. So obviously we have already built into this model of this bill a mechanism for private royalty holder, for all that oil that goes to private royalty holders, that's 5% of the gross. So it's not as if it's too foreign. I'm not sure where that would all go, but
there's a lot. There's a lot of debate about, you know, if we're capturing a rather relatively aggressive upside, certainly not the 37.5 that Representative Gruenberg was talking about, but among the versions that went out, the one that the House kicked out was pretty aggressive on the progressivity, something that if price changes, you didn't have to scramble around and try to fix it. But then there's a lot of debate about whether if you've got that upside, can you simultaneously demand a floor? And I've been one of those that has argued that I don't think they're mutually exclusive at all. But just, you know, there certainly is a lot of other opinion out there. I wouldn't want to say that it's a matter that we ought to just stick it in there and the floor in there, because there are a lot of people that absolutely abhor that floor. But I think it's one of those issues you're asking for, I think, that ought to be one last look as we go through.
And you know, we ought to realize that we did put a cap on it, right, on the floor of the House, on the House floor. We put a cap on the progressivity. Right. So if, you know, we could correspondingly look at a floor on the tax rate as well. Representative Berkowitz and Nangato.
Two quick points. First of all, you know, there's some discussion about modeling, and you know, there are two models that are within the state's purview, and if the legislature had been more aggressive, we could have got at them and used them. First is Department of Revenue has a modeling that they never really let us use, and the second, and what I would have found to be much more interesting in this process, would have been the DNR models, because DNR has almost been systematically excluded from participating in the discussion here, and I can't help but think it has anything to do with the fact that several members of DNR chose to leave or were forced out at a certain point. But the DNR model, by all accounts, is a pretty sophisticated model, and we ought to have access to that when it comes time to plug in numbers in instead of just waiting for people to tell us things. I think that's, you know, the legislature has to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of getting the information that we can get. We can't just be passive receptacles and take what the administration gives us. We ought to be telling them what we want and making sure they give it to us. Which sort of leads me to one of the other issues that I don't think we got to that night, but I think we have to pay some attention to, is the whole question of the auditing. And I'm a little concerned about how the auditing is proposed to exist. I raise it now as an issue to pay attention to, because I think it's an issue that cries out for some solutions.
Representative Gatto and then Curtula.
Yeah, thanks. And along with Representative Kelly, when I go through this bill, I'm sometimes really just looking for landmines. And there's a part in the very beginning that we never saw on the floor because we didn't have the bill yet, but it begins, I think, with definitions. And one of the early definitions, it says, I quote, oil and gas means oil or gas. And I read it over and over to see if there was a misprint somewhere. But there's no misprint. And so the landmine that I see is, you know, it says we're dealing with oil and gas. But anybody could say all that means is we're dealing with oil. And everything in the bill then can be shoveled over to the oil side or shoveled over to the gas side if that is in the economic best interest of the person reading that definition. So those kinds of things, you know, are, and I don't know how bad that statement really is. Maybe it's harmless, but I'll tell you, in my first reading and my 15th reading, I don't believe it's harmless. I think there's something to it.
And are you kind of meaning that, like, the gas revenue exclusion might be read as oil revenue exclusion?
Well, it's...
Under the definition?
Under the definition, just about any way you want to make it, you can exclude one to the 100% benefit of the other by using that definition, which is clearly in the very beginning, which defines everything beyond it.
Okay, we'll definitely have an address.
A legal opinion on what that really, how that can lead us down the yellow brick trail to disaster if somebody could use it to their benefit.
Well, there was an Alaska Supreme Court case, an early Supreme Court case, where the they were dealing with an insanity defense, and the Supreme Court said that that and meant or. Actually,
and hence the insanity arose.
Yeah, Representative Kinsella, before you go and say.
No, and sorry, my mind's finally starting to remember some of the things that we've been so concerned about. But just to kind of list them out, whether we take the gas completely out of the bill, abandonment costs. Incurred after the tax is enacted are now going to be deductible, and there's debate on that, whether or not that's really necessary for incentivizing. We don't have the additional audit authority or penalties. The point of production is still really confusing about where you actually have that point of production, so what's upstream of that. The definitions which you mentioned on the overhead, and finally one small one that I still think is important, and that is whether or not we should require the companies to come in with some proof that transactions are arm's length rather than putting all that burden on the state. So I made a little list of those, but I'll get you more, but just to kind of get it out tonight before I forget.
Representative Kelly.
Just one thing, Mr. Chairman, as we're wrapping up here, that I think we want to remember. We sent a bill to the Senate that for a period of time was 22.5%. The wheels fell off of that about 3:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. We went it down to 21.5% with a fairly aggressive progressivity. We sent that bill to the Senate. It failed there. Why? Because it was too low or too high?
Yes.
It failed there. Yes. Because it was too low.
Both.
Well, it was.
And or.
But it was blocked from passage. I believe, because it was too low. Uh-huh. I just think as we head back into the chute here, we need to remember that there is a history of this in the bodies over a period of time here, and not lose sight of the of why the bill that we sent from here didn't pass on the other side.
And you know, you should have in your stuff there, does everybody have in their packet the chart of the side-by-sides, or are they over
yes.
there and didn't
no,
get,
they're
did,
there.
Did, yeah. Were they in there? And I don't have one of mine. Anyway, if people take a look at those and see any other additional issues or any additional issues that they want to look at in here, I mean, there are going to be big things that are, you know, like the rates, which are going to be decided by the whole body. And our purpose here is to raise some issues, get some definitions, get some clarity of understanding around the issues internal in these bills, so that we can make sure that we know what we're deciding and you know, carry on that discussion. So I really appreciate everybody's participation in this, and as this, I know we've got a lot of information in gas, but this oil tax piece is going to be a huge piece, and we want to make sure we do it right, because it may be with us for a long time, or it may be that it's the only thing that's with us, depending upon what the legislature does, but we want to make sure we get all the pieces as right as we can, and I appreciate the conversation with everybody here tonight. Representative Berkowitz?
Yeah, I just want to make one final point. There's something else that's different from when we debated it, and that's we've had a look at the gas contract. And a lot of the discussion prior to seeing the gas contract was concerned that whatever happened with an oil tax was somehow going to affect the gas contract. Well, we've now seen the gas contract, and I would think that people's estimations of what they consider the gas contract, how viable they think it is, how attractive they think it is, how locked in they think the producers and the administration are, will have an impact on how the subsequent oil debate goes. So, you know, if you think it's a good gas contract, you might stay low. But if you think it's not such a good gas contract, probably things are going to go up.
Any other comments tonight? I did want to let everybody know that I had requested Econ 1 and also Pedro Van Meers today to give us an analysis on the gas revenue exclusion, and I gave to both of them the Robin Wilson's identifying that of how much of an exclusion that meant, and so hopefully we'll hear back from them as to whether that is, you know, a correct analysis and what that means and how we go about correcting that if we need to within our bill. Representative Gatto?
Yeah, thank you. In House Resources, we had talked, I think, if I recollect correctly, $75 oil. If I remember Representative Samuel saying, everybody's making so much money at that point that the progressivity just ends right there. But in this Econ 1 chart, the chart stops at $75, but the graph on the next page stops at $80, which...
Yeah, just a correction. In House Resources, the original progressivity stopped at $150, and that's when it reached 30%. However, then we found that the 30% was deductible, and so it really only turned out to be 24%, and that's why we went up to the 37.5%, because it was on the gross, to give us an equal share of gas, I mean equal share of petroleum tax credit. And then if you'll remember, we came back and I said, well, gee, why are we only going up at 0.3% between $130 and $131? So we had to, after 110, we came and said we're just going to jump to an equal share, and then everybody got cited against about the wall,
yeah,
you know, that was there. But it was in Health Resources, we capped it at 50%, which is exactly what came back on the floor of the House, and we capped the percentage at 50% to.
So if we extended these out, they would go asymptotic at 50%?
That's right, they'll come up and cap at 50%.
Were they actually sharp-edged or,
yep,
or actually
no, it
cruise there?
It'll go up at its same slope, and then when it reaches 50%, it's capped at 50% was the motion that was made. That was Representative Wyrock's amendment that it won't. It'll be capped at 50%.
So that's why we just share it.
Yeah, and then it's an equal share. Right. Any other comments? Okay, appreciate it. If anybody in the audience wants to give us information or questions as well, or things that we need clarification on, we appreciate all the information, and we'll be adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. When are you planning on getting back together again?
Tonight at midnight.
Midnight.
Yep, midnight tonight.
Okay, a little nap.